Good afternoon, brethren. I spoke with Wayne Rogers this morning and told him that I would say hello to him as well online. Hello, Wayne, and anyone else online who is tuning in today. Appreciate your tuning in to us. Today, we will be giving part two of a sermon that I started. Well, if you want the truth of this, this sermon series started back in January when I gave a message on what is living faith. And in that, we explored living faith is living your faith. It's the tangible evidence in our lives that we believe in God and we believe God and we do what God says. I followed that up instinctively, I think, with what is living hope. Peter calls it living hope. And what is living hope? If it is not an acknowledgement, a realistic expectation that God is going to fulfill what he says he's going to fulfill and our destiny is sure on God's part. And that causes then a desire on our part to transform our lives, to become like Jesus Christ. That is living hope. And of course, if you're going to go with what is faith and what is hope, if your brain doesn't jump to 1 Corinthians 13:13 automatically, and I'll read that for you here briefly, you're familiar with it. And now abides faith, hope, love, these three. But the greatest of these is love. So my brain went there. I'm sure your brain did too. And so the message I gave most recently then was part one. What is the greatest of these? Love. What is that? And so we began and we started to explore what love is and why it's called the greatest of these three great virtues. We recognize that in the English language, love is very broad. We use it for everything. So I can love my wife, and I can love my kids, and I can love my mom, and I can love my truck, and I can love my job, and it's all the same word love. We don't have ways of distinguishing types of love in the word itself in the English language. So when someone says something as silly or brazen as, I really love my truck, you have to know the context to know. Well, he's not talking about the deep abiding passion that he feels towards his wife. At least he's not supposed to. So and if he does, that's a whole other set of problems. So we discover then that love in the English language is somewhat challenging. We have to know the context in order to understand how it's being used. In the Greek, we look in the Bible for the word love, and yes, the word love in the New Testament is used repeatedly, but the word under that, the word that it is translated from is the Greek. In the Greek language, we have multiple words for love that help us to understand more readily the context or what's being meant by the word. So, for example, they have the word eros, E-R-O-S, and that is a word that implies romance. It's sexual love, sensual love, and it is certainly the love that is shared between a husband and wife in a marital relationship. We have another term, storge, which expresses familial love. My mom was asking me this morning, and I think this is kind of on point with this, you know, a desire for every parent is that their children become best friends in life. We've enjoyed seeing that in our children. They all love each other. They spend a lot of time together. In some ways, I think they're all their own best friends, and that's great for a parent. And she was asking us as we were driving to church, you know, how come you and your brothers aren't closer like that? And I remember this term. I feel storge towards them, the Greek term for familial love. I mean, it's a natural love that I have for my brothers. We have very divergent interests. They don't go to church. We don't share the same faith in God. And so from there, the distance is even greater between us because we just don't have very many things in common. I still have storge towards them, that type of love towards them. So it's a natural kind of love. There's a third type of love that's described in the Greek. It's called philia, P-H-I-L-I-A. Storge, if you need it, that spelling is S-T-O-R-G-E. That's storge. Philia, P-H-I-L-I-A, that expresses not only brotherly love, but friendship, camaraderie. It's actually a very broad term in the Greek. It's the most common term in Greek. It would be the word that we use like love. They use philia for a lot of things that broadly covers this area of having strong affection towards someone or something. So that's the way philia is used. All three of those do express some level of emotion, some connection, some feelings related to people that are in those categories based on the type of love that describes that category. Okay? There's a fourth type of love. Now, this love is somewhat different because in the first three types of love, there is either there's just no control. So, for example, storge, I don't have any control over that. I was born into a family. I have a familial relationship with my siblings. And so by means of that relationship, I have feelings towards them. But when it comes to eros, when it comes to philia, they almost always require a reciprocation. They expect something in return for those feelings. A husband and wife who don't conjugate together in their relationship, at some point that becomes a problem in a relationship. There is a reciprocation desired and affection shown. If I don't show my wife affection, after a while I know I have not shown her enough affection. She lets me know. There's a reciprocation required here. I'm giving you affection. I surely expect you to give me some. Okay, that's fair. Philia is similar in that regard. It expects something in return for those feelings that you share. You don't have friendships with people you spend a lot of time with unless the relationship is reciprocated. I think we recognize that element. The fourth term for love in the Greek is called agape. A-G-A-P-E. Agape. That, to the Greeks, that word has a very simplistic meaning in the sense of how they apply it. They usually only means one thing to them, unconditional love. This is the love that does not expect something in return for it. It is not conditional upon return. You recognize that term when you look at a mother to a child who, when it's an infant, we have two brand new babies, Jack and... don't tell me I know it already. It's Callum. So there are two brand new babies, and you see the parents, they're exhausted. They're shedding tiredness because they're getting up at 2 and 3 o'clock in the morning. That baby cannot possibly reciprocate love at their age. They're just a baby. And so the mom unconditionally gets up at 3 o'clock in the morning to take care of the baby's needs. So we can recognize sort of this unconditional love. We see it most easily then in how a mother and a child are in a normal relationship, in a normal healthy family. Yet what's interesting biblically is that that word agape and that Greek definition for agape doesn't go far enough for God. And so biblically God co-opts this term and redefines it or adds to it, because unconditional love certainly is a part of godly love. But it's not exclusively that. In fact, we know now that it's much more than that. I want to make sure that I stay somewhat close. There is a lot of material on agape love. I thought I was going to be able to finish this message today, and it's literally impossible. I have tried to condense this into just two parts, but it's not going to be possible. I'm going to have to do a third part to try to finish it in three parts. And that's because I'm doing it somewhat differently than others have done it. I'm going to cover the material for you, but I'm going to give you this admission up front. I can only give you a tiny bit of each of the attributes of godly love. If you study it for yourself, you're going to see the depth of each one of these attributes. Each one is worthy of a sermon on its own, so it's unfair for me to try to give you all the range and depth of each one in a message that's just designed to touch on each one, to give us a sense of what agape is, and then hopefully each of us on our own can study in more depth to see the richness of the meaning of agape. Here's what we learned in the first message, though. Let me summarize for you what we learned, as Christ basically defines this in the Scripture, because agape, you won't find a single definition in the Scripture. Instead, what you find is examples of how it's used. And it's in those examples that we flesh out the meaning. Okay? So what we fleshed out in the first message was, number one, it is not an emotional response. So agape is not an emotional response. So in the other types of love, they are directly connected to emotions. They're emotionally based. Nothing wrong with that. God gave those to us. Number two, it involves a way of thinking. It involves motives. Agape involves motives. It involves self-sacrifice. Probably one of the most challenging aspects of agape is this aspect, that agape requires self-sacrifice. Number four, it is not contingent upon the other person giving something to us. It's not reciprocal. It does not require reciprocation. The others, as I mentioned, have an element of that, right? Number five, it involves action. Agape involves action. Agape is unselfish and outgoing concern for everyone. It's not evidenced by how we feel, but rather by how we act. We actually owe, Christ says, owe agape to each other. We owe that to each other as a debt. And that debt doesn't care whether or not we share the same ideas, the same religion, the same feelings about something. We don't have to share anything. In fact, I owe that debt to somebody that I might even think is unworthy of love altogether. I still owe them agape. That's the beginning of the understanding of agape and how challenging this is for us, and this is why this must be a part of who we become. If this describes God, God is agape, that's a definition. If that describes God and we are to become like God, then therefore we can rightly conclude we must become agape. We must become the love that defines God. Now, we are going to be using 1 Corinthians chapter 13 today. You might mark your Bible there, since we will go there. We'll move to other places, but we will always come back to 1 Corinthians chapter 13. I'd like to give you complementary passage, maybe. A passage that covers the same material but does it slightly differently, but helps to flesh out the material. You might make a note for yourselves, Romans chapter 12. It's a good companion was the word I was thinking. It's a very excellent companion passage or chapter to 1 Corinthians chapter 13. A lot of the same material is covered in Romans chapter 12. The audience is different, and so how it's presented is slightly different, but I think it will help you to flesh out the material itself a little bit better. So I wanted to give that to you before I forgot to do that. One of the questions that I asked in the first message was, why did Paul, in 1 Corinthians chapter 13, why did he decide then to cover the subject of agape as strongly as he does in particular? Well, you obviously know that the Bible isn't written the way that you see it laid out here. It's not written in chapter and verse. When I write a business letter, I have my paragraphs organized, but I don't number them. I don't number the sentences so that you can quickly follow or tell someone where to go in a letter that I've written. That's just not how we write. And certainly, these epistles were not written that way either. And so it's easy for us to look at a chapter as being something somehow independent of other chapters, meaning it must carry other material. The fact of the matter is, it's a letter. From beginning to end, it's one letter. It's not 13 or 14 letters, it's one. And so when we look at context, you don't just look at the context within the chapter itself because it's a letter. So you might have to go back further to capture context. And so last week, we walked through elements from 1 Corinthians chapter 1 all the way through chapter 12 to see the context. What's the background? Why is Paul going to talk about love? And we saw that he's talking to a church that's spiritually sick. They had a lot of problems. Here's some of the problems that Paul addressed. Division in the church. Sexual immorality. Pride and arrogance. Lying, cheating and stealing among the brethren to each other. Some were hiring prostitutes. Others knew about it. Irreverent worship. Spiritual gifts wasted and even lorded over each other as badges of honor and signifying my great spiritualness over someone else's, right? I couldn't think of another way to finish that word. We'll go with spiritualness. Okay. So that's the context. Now today, I want to go back to 1 Corinthians chapter 12 because of how 1 Corinthians 13 begins. Its most relevant context is chapter 12. It's the run-up to the content of chapter 13. So I want to begin here. We'll pick up 1 Corinthians chapter 12 in verse 1, then I want to just skip to verse 4 just for brevity and to try to stay within the time constraints. We'll read only what I think is necessary. So in verse 1, it says, "Now concerning spiritual gifts, brethren, I do not want you to be ignorant." So now we know the context is going to be, for the next whatever period of time, he's going to be talking about spiritual gifts. This is very important to this particular congregation because of how they treated spiritual gifts. Now we have to understand, they had been given spiritual gifts. This isn't a question of Paul addressing an unconverted congregation. He's dealing with converted Christians who have been given gifts by God through the Holy Spirit. It's how they were using them, how they thought of them. So let's pick this up down in verse 4. "There are diversities of gifts, but it's the same Spirit," he's saying, "that gives it. And there are diversities of activities, but it's the same God who works all in all. But the manifestation of the Spirit is given to each one for the profit of all." You weren't given your gift for yourself. It wasn't given to set you up. It wasn't given to you to make you better, to distinguish you in the congregation. It was given to you for the edification of the congregation. How are they using those gifts if that's what Paul is saying there were for? "For to one is given the word of wisdom through the Spirit. To another, the word of knowledge through the same Spirit. To another, faith by the same Spirit. To another, gifts of healings by the same Spirit. To another, the working of miracles. To another, prophecy. To another, discerning of spirits. To another, different kinds of tongues. To another, the interpretation of tongues. But one and the same Spirit works all of these things, distributing to each one individually as it wills," as God wills. Let's drop down all the way to verse 27. Verse 27, we pick up the theme or the thought here. It says, "Now you are the body of Christ and members individually." Yes, each and every one of us, same today. Each of us are individuals, but we are placed within one body. One body. All of us working together form a single body, and therefore those gifts were intended so that they serve the whole body, not the individual member. Verse 28, "And God has appointed these in the church, first apostles, second prophets, third teachers, after that miracles, then gifts of healings, helps, administrations, varieties of tongues." What's interesting here is, you'll notice Paul was the one who says, first apostles. He says, second prophets. He's numbering these. I don't have to number them. Paul numbered them. Third teachers. This is a hierarchy of importance. You know why it's important? Because of what Paul knew about this church. They placed the bottom at the top. To them, the ability to speak in tongues was the most high level of manifestation of the Spirit, as opposed to what Paul said the greatest gift was. They place tongues above everything else. So he says, "Are all apostles? Are all prophets? Are all teachers? Are all workers of miracles? Do all have gifts of healings? Do all speak with tongues? Do all interpret? But earnestly desire the best gifts." No question about that. "But yet," he says, "I show you a more excellent way." This is the backdrop. This is the foundation. This leads us into what he wants to talk about, a more excellent way. Well, what way would that be? Now let's turn over to 1 Corinthians chapter 13. And let's read verse 1. "Though I speak with tongues of men." Now why did he start there? Because to a congregation who says speaking in tongues is the greatest of the gifts, I speak in tongues, I'm the greatest of all. I'm better than you because I have this gift. Paul starts right there. Okay. "Though you speak with tongues of men," great. How about this? "And can converse with angels," because that's what he says next. "Though I speak with the tongues of men and of angels, but I have not love, I've become a sounding brass or a clanging cymbal." Thought it was interesting, Mr. Albright, for our second or third hymn today, we sang that very song. We sang this very passage today. I love it when that happens. The word tongue, here the word tongues refers to languages, okay? Do you know how many languages there are known in the world today? Raise your hand if you think there's more than 1,000. Fair. Raise your hand if you think there's more than 2,000. Raise your hand if you think there's more than 3,000. Some of you already know. Raise your hand if you think there's more than 5,000. Raise your hand if you think there's more than 7,000. 7,111 is the current number. It changes and grows over time. You know, some languages go extinct because there aren't that many people who speak them. Other languages change and grow out of seemingly out of nowhere. There are morphing or something happens in a language will develop it all on its own. Ebonics might be that. I don't know if it's called that or not. I'm just joking. I think about languages that change over time. Anyway, 7,111, and Paul is saying, okay, what if you could speak 7,111 languages and understood all of those languages as well? That would be something pretty remarkable. Okay? Moreover, he says, wait a minute, what if you actually understood the language of angels and you could converse with angels? You could speak directly, you had a conversation, maybe every day you're having a conversation with an angel. Great. If you don't have agape, what's that worth? That's his question. What's that worth? Well, he says, it's worth this. Do you know what he means by sounding brass? We've probably all heard this at least at one level. But let me explain to you something. Have you ever heard, even like Google or on a nature show, have you heard a bull elk bugle? It's kind of a loud but screech sound. It feels like nails going down a chalkboard to you. It's not designed to be beautiful music. It's a bull elk bugling. But if you've ever heard someone beginning to learn to play the trumpet or a brass instrument, it sounds a lot the same. So it's not beautiful music. It's hard on the ears. It feels like nails on a chalkboard. And I've actually done that. And that's, you know that feeling. Right? Have you ever done that when you were in school? Kind of that same feeling. Gives you the shivers up the spines. Okay, well, if that doesn't work for you, he says, or a clanging cymbal. So somebody said that somebody bought their grandson a drum set. I don't know if it's in this congregation or not, but somebody I heard recently say they bought their grandson a drum set. And I'm thinking, I know what that's going to sound like for a long time in that house. That's a lot of clanging. And it's not beautiful music. It's just going to be really hard to sit through, really hard to endure. And that's what Paul's saying. It has that value. In other words, there's no music in it. You don't want to listen to that because there's no music in it. Now, if I heard Louis Armstrong, it's not a great example because I don't like freestyle jazz, but if you like that, he's producing some pretty good notes on a trumpet. Or Neil Peart, I think it was, really excellent drummer from the band Rush, I think it was, years ago. I think he's still playing even. Anyway, there's some fantastic drummers out there who do a great... Phil Collins was a fantastic drummer before he launched his singing career. Anyway, Paul's giving those examples. If you pick your own, if you heard somebody learn to play the violin, we did. We had our daughter Rachel do that. That's fun, seriously. Or the clarinet, or the saxophone. The point is, you get the point, okay? If it's not making beautiful music, then of what value is it? Well, nobody wants to sit through the practice part because that's really hard. So that's what he's saying. There's no value there. Okay. The church at Corinth placed a high value on speaking in tongues, and that's why Paul begins this discussion on love by poking his finger directly in their sore spot. This is not of any value, and you place a lot of value in it. But it has no value if it doesn't have agape. That's what Paul's conclusion is. He says, of what value is it to be able to speak in any language to any person in the world or to converse daily with angels if you don't have agape? No value. Verse 2. Chapter 13, verse 2 of 1 Corinthians, it says, and though I have the gift of prophecy and understand all mysteries and all knowledge, and though I have all faith so that I could remove mountains, but have not love, I am nothing. That's pretty strong stuff. Regarding the gift of prophecy, let me quote from Albert Barnes. This word properly means to predict future events, But it also means to declare the divine will, to interpret the purposes of God, or to make known in any way the truth of God, which is designed to influence people. You know, the Bible describes God as being the God of mysteries. God does reserve for himself all knowledge, does he not? I think we explored that in recent messages even, that it is up to God to reveal, and only God can reveal, because only God knows. So it is to God's honor to conceal, and it is to man's honor, or it is why God, what he gave to us, to try to discover what is concealed. We have to discover what God already knows. In other words, Paul is saying, but what if God did do that for you? What if he revealed all of the mysteries to you? Are there mysteries to us in the church today? Yes, there are. A lot of things we simply don't know. We have to be honest with ourselves about that. What we do know is that God gave us everything we need to know for salvation right here. It's in here if we need it for salvation. But there's much that we don't actually need for salvation, so it hasn't been revealed to us. One day it will be. Paul says, well, what if God did that now? Not only that, but what if he opened your mind and you actually knew everything he knew? What an incredible blessing that would be. For those of us who like and who pursue and who like to study, that would be fantastic to know everything that God knows. How incredible would that be? If you did that, if that happened for you, what if by faith you literally could move a mountain? Paul, you know, if you remember, Peter actually walked on water by faith. He actually did that. And Paul is saying, okay, so if you have that level of faith that you could do that, so now you know all the mysteries. You have all the knowledge of God. You've got the same faith of Jesus Christ. You can walk on water, whatever, move a mountain. Paul says, if you were able to prophesy for God, to know all the mysteries God has kept secret, to have all the knowledge that God has, and to have such profound faith that you could literally move mountains, walk on water, whatever, of what value is that if you do not have agape? He says, if all that were true about any of us, if that were true about us, but we didn't have agape, I am nothing, is what he says. Nothing. That's its value. Zero. That's profound when you think about what he's saying about how important agape is then. Is it possible to have agape and not understand some prophecy or have some knowledge? This is sort of like the question that says, are all Californians Americans? Yes. But are all Americans Californians? No. It's a similar type of a proposition. If you have agape, you're going to have some knowledge. Can you have some knowledge and not have agape? Yes. That's why he's saying these things. You have these things. You have these gifts. Tells me that you've got the Spirit, because you can't have the gifts unless you've got the Spirit. If you have the gifts, you've got the Spirit. Can you have the Spirit and not have agape? Yes. But can you have agape without the Spirit? No. It's impossible. Something for us to understand about that. He says, yes, you can have the Holy Spirit and all of these other things and not have agape. And if all these things were true, without agape, they're worthless. Verse 3, 1 Corinthians 13, 3. And though, this is interesting how he's transitioning now to, and Paul loves to do this, by the way. He loves to answer a question before you've asked it or thought to ask it. So he's going to do this for the person who says to themselves, but though I bestow all my goods to feed the poor, and though I give my body to be burned, but have not love, it profits me nothing. So the person that says, I have all knowledge, I have all of the mysteries solved in the Bible, I know everything there, I'm a prophet of God, I can tell you what's going to happen because God has revealed that to me, I can tell you that. So I have the gift of prophecies, the gift of knowledge of mysteries, and the gift of all knowledge, and all these things. He's saying, okay, great, you've got all that. The person that says, I have all that, but wait a minute, I can raise my hand and say I've got more than that, because I sold all my worldly goods to feed the poor. And at the end of my life, I sacrificed my life in martyrdom for my beliefs. Okay, that's the next level, right? And he says, okay, so you can claim all of that. If you don't have agape, it's worthless. It means nothing. None of that means anything. So where is he placing agape? Above everything else. It's the most important thing. Of course, it makes sense when you read the scripture that says God is agape. Above everything else. He is everything. If we're to become that, then everything else is subordinate to that. Agape, then, is the most important thing we are to pursue. It's more important than faith, he says. It's more important than hope. And those are still required. But if you've done that, you haven't done it all. You've still come up short. That's what he's saying. Can you do good deeds and not have agape? Christ says in Matthew chapter 7, if you want to read this with me, to the person who says, but I did good deeds. Okay, let's see what Christ said about that. As though the deeds have value. Matthew chapter 7 and verse 21. Christ says, not everyone who says to me, Lord, Lord, shall enter the kingdom of heaven, but he who does the will of my Father in heaven. Verse 22, many will say to me in that day, Lord, Lord, have we not prophesied in your name, cast out demons in your name, done many wonders in your name? Didn't we do all these good works in your name? And then I will declare to them, I never knew you. Depart from me, you who practice lawlessness. We don't get to live a life contrary to God, do some good deeds, and say that makes up for it. Nope, it doesn't work that way. You don't get to live lawlessly and claim to be a son of God. It's what he's saying. Is it possible to become a martyr and not have agape? Sure. You know how many Catholic priests were martyred during the 9th and 10th century by Viking raiders? Many. You know how many Muslims were martyred during the 14th and 15th century by Catholic crusaders? Many. Would you say they have agape? Well, I'd have to look at their life to know that for a fact, but the fact of the matter is, it's hard to have agape if you don't have the Spirit. It's impossible, in fact. You have to have the Spirit of God. So is it possible to be martyred for your beliefs? Which just means to die for what you believe in. You can die believing that you're saving the whales. Some have. And yet, does that mean they have agape? I would say they've got a lot of philia towards the whales. But not agape. The question here is, what is the motive? That's the question. So if we're going to analyze the question or analyze the subject of agape, and we're going to try to begin to understand, it's the pinnacle. And if I can do these things, but they don't mean I've got agape, then how do I know if I have agape? The answer is, what's the motive for doing those things? If you gave away all of your goods to the poor so that you look good, you can thump your chest and walk around telling everybody how great you are as a Christian because you feed the poor with the worldly goods that you had. Great. If their motivation is you, that's not agape. If you die on the cross or if you get martyred for your beliefs, but that belief came from inside of you that had nothing to do with the other, didn't have anything to do with God's creation in terms of mankind, your fellow man, this isn't about our agape towards an animal. This is agape towards each other, what we owe each other, agape. This is the backdrop. Let me give you a simple definition that I think you'll find runs and rings true for agape as we move through the rest of this chapter. Agape is doing what is best for the other person despite their actions or our emotions or personal consequences. Okay? If you want to write it down, agape is doing what is best for the other person despite their actions or how we feel, our emotions, or personal consequences. What might happen to me if I do show agape? You're going to see as we walk through the elements of this, then the attributes that Paul then next gives to us, you're going to see this is the theme. This is the underlying message to what agape is. This is how we see how to apply it. Again, I'm only going to be able to touch briefly on each of these points. Now, what's interesting here is the first ones that Paul gives us here in verse 4. 1 Corinthians 13, verse 4, he says, love suffers long and is kind. He begins to explain what agape is in the positive attributes first. And he says, it suffers long and is kind. Then he's going to lay out a series of what it is not. So we're going to spend time on the first two, proportionate to how Paul did. Or how it means, I should say it that way. In proportion to what they mean. Agape suffers long and is kind. Because these two are the flip sides of the same coin. Suffers long on one side, is kind on the other side. They're two sides of the same coin of this attribute. What does it mean to suffer long? Thayer defines this term as to persevere patiently and bravely in enduring misfortunes and troubles. To be patient in bearing the offenses and injuries of others. It's probably self-evident, if you have a word that says long-suffering, that for us to build the skill of long-suffering, we're probably going to have to suffer a long time. Would you agree? Or else it wouldn't be called long-suffering. It'd be called short-suffering. If you only had to suffer for a short time. I've suffered for a short time. That's not that big of a deal. I suffer every time I fly. I've confessed to you guys this before. I hate flying anymore because it's just such a pain to me. So I suffer every time I fly, but it's short-term suffering, right? Because, I mean, you get on the plane, 5 hours later, you get off, you're done. Okay, so that's not what we're talking about here. Long-term suffering means long-term suffering. Suffering over something for a long period of time. Why would you do that? Why would you be willing to do that? This is why I said I can only give you an aspect of this stuff. It's way too deep. If I were to go through that, that's an entire sermon to talk about long-suffering and all of the areas in which that might touch our lives, all of the biblical examples of long-suffering, years and years and years and years and years of waiting, of being hurt, of taking abuse, so forth. That's long-suffering, and it's certainly a big message. I'll just give you one thing that relates to us as we are brothers and sisters in Christ. I'll give you one example that we can look to. 1 Corinthians chapter 8, what you'll find as you go through chapter 13, many of what Paul describes as the attributes or the negative attributes, meaning agape is not this or it's not that, you're going to find he's already touched on it earlier in the chapter or in the book. And so we can find examples here, and we're going to in 1 Corinthians chapter 8, we'll find an example of one of the meanings of long suffering. And it truly applies to us in the church. You'll have to adapt that in your own mind to say, well, how would that apply today? We're going to look at a situation that was contemporary for their time. Okay? 1 Corinthians chapter 8 and verse 4, it says, therefore, concerning the eating of things offered to idols, we know that an idol is nothing in the world, and that there is no other God but one. For even if there are so-called gods, he uses a lowercase G intentionally here as being not gods, but called gods, whether in heaven or on earth, as there are many gods and many lords, yet for us there is one God, the Father, of whom are all things, and we for him, and one Lord, Jesus Christ, through whom are all things, and through whom we live. However, there is not in everyone that knowledge. Some are new. Some barely understand the beginning inklings of the truth. And they're clinging to them. What they do understand, they're clinging to. For some, with consciousness of the idol, until now, eat it as a thing offered to an idol. And their conscience, being weak, is defiled. But food does not commend us to God, for neither if we eat are we the better, nor if we do not eat are we the worse. But beware lest somehow this liberty of yours becomes a stumbling block to those who are weak. For if anyone sees you who have knowledge eating in an idol's temple, will not the conscience of him who is weak be emboldened to eat those things offered to idols? So, he sees you, he believes, he's a new Gentile convert, and of course you know in the area of Greco-Macedonia, all of the different gods that they had and all of the different sacrificial processes and so forth, all of the temple worship that was going on, if they sacrificed a clean animal and sold it in the market, we know that there's no God there. That's just cut meat as far as we're concerned. And so for us, that looks like a good backstrap. Let's have that for dinner tonight. Okay? But to the convert who comes in contemporaneously, now this is contemporary to their time. The new convert who comes into the area who knows that meat is being sacrificed to idols and who has yet in his understanding to realize that there's only one God. What they do is futile and worthless. It's meaningless. But to them, they might believe that doing that might offend God. And they therefore wouldn't do it. But they see you doing it, and not because they understand that it doesn't offend God, but because they see you do it, might become emboldened to do it simply because they see you do it. And that violates their conscience, and that is described as sin. When you go against your conscience, whether you understand it correctly or not, when you go against your conscience, God says that's a sin. So if I cause someone to stumble because in my liberty, I know already, I understand already, how am I showing them agape? I just don't care, apparently. Maybe they're weak, and I'm like, they'll figure it out one day. Not my problem. Is it? Really? Is that what agape means then? It's not my problem? Because that's not what Paul is saying. And because of your knowledge shall the weak brother perish for whom Christ died. But when you thus sin against the brethren, he's saying, if you do that, that's a sin on you. And wound their weak conscience, you sin against Christ. Therefore, Paul says, if food makes my brother stumble, I will never eat meat again, lest I make my brother stumble. That's how Paul views agape. It's up here. Eating a piece of meat is down here someplace. Agape is up here. That means if I could potentially cause my brother to stumble, I'll just be a vegetarian, and that's okay by me. Now, if you happen to love meat as much as some of us love meat, the idea of being a vegetarian your whole life simply because you didn't want to cause an offense, that's suffering a long time. I know. There are some of us who really love our meat. So that is long suffering. And that's what Paul's talking about. That's just one example. If you walk through the Bible, you're going to find many different types of long sufferings that we will go through, whether that's caring for an elderly parent, a sick relative. Those are certainly periods of long suffering. It's difficult, very difficult to do that. You can think of all kinds of examples where you might suffer long for what? For the benefit of the other person, regardless of how I feel about it, what they've done, or how it impacts me. That's agape. That's what Paul says. I've been using a phrase that, I don't know, it just dawned on me a couple years ago, because it seemed appropriate at the time. The phrase is this: love them where they are. Love them where they are. We're not all on the same, we're not at the same place in our spiritual journeys, though we're all taking a spiritual journey. But rarely do we find ourselves at the same spot at the same time as someone else who's in the faith, do we? We love them where they are. If their understanding is something weaker than ours, how many of us have tried to fix somebody's understanding without their permission? Right? I mean, honestly, if you've been baptized for any length of time, you're guilty. We all know that we're guilty of that. We have to learn to love them where they are. Sometimes that means they're weak enough in the faith that if I do this particular thing, that will be an offense to them. I don't want to do that to them. I have to start thinking in different terms then. That's what Paul's talking about. We have to start thinking differently about each other, and not just about each other. Yes, it starts first with the household of God, but we owe this to all men. Everyone. The flip side of this coin, because we've been talking about the passive, haven't we? Suffering a long time, unless you're doing it loudly, it's supposed to be suffering, you know, internal suffering, right? Your own suffering. That's a passive thing. That's what you do passively for others. I endure for your benefit. So we have the passive side of the coin, and when we flip that coin over, we have the active side, because he says it is long-suffering and is kind. I think to myself, have you endured something for some period of time? And I think all of us can recognize maybe something in our lives where we've done that, and we can probably relate to it. But it's easy for us being human beings to forget that not do we just suffer long, but we have an obligation to be kind to them in the process. So there are many ways in which we might not be kind to them. I might feel resentment and anger because I've had to give up eating meat because I have a newly converted brother or sister who would be offended by that. Let's put ourselves back in this time period. Okay? So how do I respond to that, brother? Am I mean to them then after that? Am I discourteous to them? Am I rude to them? Am I angry with them? Or am I kind to them? Do I love them where they are? Hopefully God will open their mind to understand that eating meats offered to idol is not a problem. I hope that happens. I will pray for them daily that God opens their eyes, because for me that would be to relieve my long suffering. So maybe that's a selfish prayer, but you kind of do think that's for their benefit, so I'm praying for that, because they will love meat, you know, once they understand it, they would love it. So that's the point. All right. Being kind is our active response while passively enduring. That's why they're part of the same coin. One is the passive, one is the active. One is what am I enduring? The other is how am I acting when I'm enduring? How do I treat that other person? We owe them kindness. We love them where they are. The second thing Paul says in 1 Corinthians chapter 13, because remember, there are four things in this one verse 4. There are four things to cover here. Number two, he says, agape does not envy. I gave a sermon years ago on enemies of thankfulness, enemies of thankfulness. And one of them is envy. Do you remember what envy is? The dictionary, Merriam-Webster's dictionary, describes envy this way: painful or resentful awareness of an advantage enjoyed by another, joined with a desire to possess the same advantage. You know the key phrase in that, right? Painful or resentful. They're feelings. To envy is to feel resentful and unhappy towards another because they possess or have achieved what one wishes to possess or achieve for one's self. Envy seeks to deny the other person of having what they possess or have achieved because one desires these for one's self. It's the, I would take it from them to have it for myself. I don't want them to have it. I want it for me. How do I know if I have envy? Envy reveals itself when you feel pain, when someone else has obtained or achieved something that we desire to obtain or achieve for ourselves. If you hurt when you see someone else achieve something you've wanted to achieve or obtain something you've wanted to obtain, when you hurt inside over that, that's envy. If you want to have a very clear understanding of envy, look today at the social justice movement. That is envy on display. It seeks to deny the haves to give to the have-nots. That's what it's about. I'm not saying that the have-nots don't have a right to want or desire. I'm saying envy is when you would take it from someone, when you hurt over it, so painfully so that you are angry with that person. You would take it from them. You would deny them. That's envy. And that's wrong. James chapter 3 and verse 14. James gives us something that's very important about this, because he connects envy with something we don't want to be connected with. There you go. James chapter 3 and verse 14. But if you have bitter envy and self-seeking in your hearts, Do not boast and lie against the truth. This wisdom does not descend from above, but is earthly, sensual, demonic. Envy, one of the attributes of envy is demonic. For where envy and self-seeking exist, confusion and every evil thing are there. When James uses the word wisdom, he uses it exactly the way Paul uses it in 1 Corinthians. It's the same word. You know what it means. Last message we described for you, the first three chapters, very nearly completely, Paul in those first three chapters of 1 Corinthians connects the idea of human carnality with the wisdom or the way of the world. He uses wisdom, repeatedly uses the word wisdom, and he's defining the wisdom or the way of the world as being carnal, the opposite of being godly. James is using this exactly the same way. This word wisdom, you could substitute carnality. This carnality does not descend from above. Envy does not come from God. And therefore, when he says agape is not envy, does not envy. You understand why he says that? Paul helps us understand because he says almost exactly the same thing. 1 Corinthians, as I said, you'll find so many of the examples here directly in the same book he wrote. 1 Corinthians I'll get there. Chapter 3, beginning in verse 1. We'll just read the first three verses. And I, brethren, could not speak to you as to spiritual people, but as to carnal, as to babes in Christ. I fed you with milk and not with solid food, for until now you were not able to receive it. And even now you're still not able, for you are still carnal, worldly. For where there is envy, he says, strife and divisions among you, are you not carnal and behaving like mere men? Yeah, you're not behaving like God. Envy is carnal. It destroys relationships because the focus of envy is inside here. It's about me, not about the other person. The third element, the third attribute in 1 Corinthians 13, verse 4. Agape does not parade itself. Okay? Parade itself. You know, the word itself sort of gives it a little bit of a hint about it when they use the phrase parade. We think of a marching parade. Portland has their annual Rose Festival. There's a parade. There's the Rose Festival down in Pasadena. They have a big parade. There's lots of things. New York's got a famous parade, their Thanksgiving Day parade and so forth. We think of that as parade. Something on show. And he says, but agape doesn't do that. Agape doesn't do that. Thayer defines this term parade as a self-display, employing rhetorical embellishments in extolling one's self excessively. As I looked through various different commentaries and dictionaries at this word parade, the most common term that came up was braggart. Many of them actually translate the word as braggart. Braggart is always used negatively. Not ever is it used positively. When we jokingly say, hey, stop bragging about that. We're not talking about successes in life. There's a normal, natural pride in self-accomplishment. This isn't about that. I'd beam with my wife if I get published in a magazine or something that's in our industry. Why wouldn't you? You're working hard to get published, and you do. It's an acknowledgement, and it's a feather or something in the cap. It's not wrong to share that with your wife or your close friends and so forth. This isn't what this is about. He's talking here about arrogant boasting. That's really what he's talking about. And that comes from a deep desire to be the center of attention. Again, the question in sharing is, what's the motivation? I'm remembering, I think my wife said, somebody else I was talking with, I do, a lot of the young adults will contact me and they'll ask questions about resumes, for example. I'm looking to build my resume out, need some help, like to have your opinion about this or that or other thing. And I'll always tell them the same thing, you need to embellish here. That's an antithesis to us, isn't it? Embellish kind of feels like bragging. But yet on a resume, is it bragging? If I'm an employer, I want to know what you're good at. I want to know what your skills are. And I'd like some examples. So is that bragging when you do that? No. The braggart wants to be the center of attention. That's why he does it. It's about me. I want to be the center of this conversation. I want to be the center of every conversation. I have to be the center. It has to be about me. He says, that's not what agape is. It's not about you. The fourth thing, again, for the sake of time, I just have to touch on these and then move along. Agape, this again is from verse 4 of chapter 13. Agape is not puffed up. Now, this is directly connected to the previous. Because the previous example is to put on display what I feel in my heart. One is the active demonstration, the other is the internal feeling. Being puffed up. If somebody didn't say anything or do anything and you just looked at them, it's difficult to see puffed up in them. You see puffed up in action. The action demonstrates the being puffed up part. Thayer defines this term puffed up to inflate, blow up, to cause to swell up, to puff up, make proud, to be puffed up, to bear one's self loftily, to be proud. So as you saw earlier, between long-suffering and kindness, two sides of the same coin. One passive, the other active. We have a similar connection here between boasting and pride. One is the outward example of it. One is the outward demonstration. The other is the internal feeling. Okay? This is talking about hubris, pride, arrogant, self-importance. Because pride or hubris swells the mind with self-importance. And if I'm important in how I feel about myself inside, naturally I want everyone else to think I'm important. And that's why we manifest what's inside here. We manifest that to other people. And we might not even see it. I can tell you that, side note, I can tell you that it is very possible for us to have faults and sins within us that we simply don't see. And I went through this myself years ago when Mr. Dick said to me, there's something that you do when you speak that I really want you to work on. And then he told me what it was. I'm like, got no idea. I can't even picture a time when I have done what you're talking about the way you're talking about it. And he's well, that's fine. That's fine. Then one day Beck says, you just did it when I sat down. I'm like, what? And then it finally dawned on me. You can do something for a long time, not be aware of what you're doing. And it could be wrong. And you just might not be aware of it. So I'm not saying that these things are all easy to overcome. We're all on a journey down a road to perfection, not the road called perfection. It's a destination. It's where we're headed. Okay. And Paul contrasts this kind of self-importance with humility. Philippians chapter 2 and verse 3. I'll give you a couple references here. Philippians chapter 2 and verse 3. Let nothing be done through selfish ambition or conceit. Conceit means pride. It means an overinflated opinion of the self. That's what it means. But in lowliness of mind, let each esteem others better than himself. He's not saying don't love yourself or to take, you know, have a normal pride in what you have succeeded at in life. Because this isn't talking about that. This is talking about that mindset of self-importance. An overinflated opinion of the self. Solomon warns us about this same thing in Proverbs. I'll give you one more. Proverbs chapter 21. We love to go to Proverbs when it comes to these kinds of principles. Proverbs chapter 21 and verse 24. A proud and haughty man, quote, scoffer is his name. He acts with arrogant pride. It's a strong and stern warning about the effect of pride. What led to Satan's downfall? Two key things were present: envy and pride. So is it a coincidence that God says agape is not envy, agape is not pride? It's the antithesis of his enemy, of our enemy. Because Satan is those things. Let's go on to verse 5, 1 Corinthians chapter 13. That's why I told you to hold your place there. If you were going to flip around with me as I move around, then you'll have to quickly find your place back, unlike me who didn't mark his Bible. Now you have to keep finding it again. 1 Corinthians chapter 13, now verse 5. Agape does not behave rudely, does not seek its own, is not provoked, thinks no evil. I'm going to have to go through these a little quicker. Agape does not behave rudely. As I said earlier, I can only touch on an aspect. I'm going to give you one aspect of what this is talking about. There are multiple layers in some of these. Does not behave rudely. Jameson, Fawcett, and Brown describes it this way. Is not uncourteous or inattentive to civility and propriety. One of the main aspects of what this means is that agape is not disrespectful. It is not, let me put it this way. Agape is respectful. It honors and is dignity. Those are the qualities that are being described here. Those are the opposite of what rudeness is. Rudeness lacks these qualities. If you turn on the TV, you can't be ignorant of what's going on politically in our country right now. I'm not picking sides. I want to illustrate this point this way. Can you find anyone saying something that isn't disrespectful, dishonorable, or discourteous to other people? Same party, different party, makes no difference. No one has any sense of, it seems like anymore, a sense of propriety, of decency, of treating another human being with respect. Whether you agree with them or not, we're no longer at the place, it seems, where you and I can disagree about something without being disagreeable. That's a problem. That's the opposite of agape. I can disagree with you about something and still treat you with respect and dignity and honor. I owe that to you. Sometimes what that means is I have to not talk about that subject with you. Okay? I have some friends down in Arizona that I spend a lot of time with in business because we're colleagues. And if it ever comes around to either religion or politics, I have to abstain. I still love them. I love them where they are. They're not called. They're not converted. There are so many other things we have in common with each other that we can talk about that I don't need to spend time talking about things we don't have in common. We'll talk about the things we do. I want to love them where they are. And I don't want there to be a contention between us. Hopefully one day in God's kingdom, I'll be able to walk up to them, shake their hands, and they'll go, wow, you were converted. I don't want it to be that bad. Like, wow, you were, that is amazing. I don't want it to be that bad. The sixth thing that agape says here about agape in this same verse here, it says agape does not seek its own. Does not seek its own. That's a little confusing to me. So I wanted to break that down just a little bit for you. Albert Barnes says this. Its evident meaning is that it is not selfish. It does not seek its own happiness exclusively or even mainly. It does not seek its own happiness to the injury of others. That's the key here. It doesn't seek its own happiness to the injury of someone else. That's a little hard for us to kind of picture, because aren't we all, don't we have a right to life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness? That's in this country, we're all big fans of that idea. That's our motto. This is more like, are you that person? I had these, again, one aspect. I'll give you one simple aspect. When I was a kid, there was a friend I had who wanted to spend time with me, and I think it's because I was his only friend. So, but when we wanted to spend time together, if I ever wanted to do something, they always trumped what I wanted to do with what they wanted to do. So, what do you want to do, Ken? Well, let's go watch a movie. How about we go bowling? I don't want to go bowling, but I do. So we're bowling. After enough times of I want to do this, but they want to do that. I want to do this, they want to do that. And if we don't do that, then we don't get to hang around with each other. After a while, I didn't want to hang around with them. I'll just find a friend who maybe will come part way. Because how do we have a relationship that's on a one-way street only going that way? Only going to the other person and nothing ever comes back. Difficult to have relationships like that last. You just can't stand it, right? Agape isn't that person. It's not to say that we don't have a right to happiness or to pursuing happiness, because we're all naturally going to pursue happiness. But he's saying, you don't make it life's ambition to pursue your happiness over anyone else's. It's not about you. Sometimes you're going to say, nope, I'm going to do what they want to do because I love them, because it'll make them happy. Even if I don't like the activity, sometimes I'm not going to eat Brussels sprouts just because of this either. Whoever is not doing it. I just want to be clear, there are certain lines I'm not willing to cross. People know that. And asparagus. I'm not doing asparagus either. All right, just be clear. All right, so it doesn't seek its own. In other words, it doesn't put its happiness above everyone else's to the point where we are not, like our self-satisfaction comes before everyone else's. So that is opposite of what agape is. It does not seek its own. Number 7, agape is not provoked. Okay, so this one is an interesting term, provoked. Now, if you're reading in the King James, you're going to see easily has been inserted in there. Because that helps to... Is it possible to never be provoked? Because I fly a lot, and so I want to know. Can you never be provoked? Or I drive in traffic. Can you never be provoked in traffic? So, yeah, but what this is talking about here, so when it says agape is not provoked, what it's saying is that agape is not easily, you are not easily provoked, okay? I'm going to give you a little bit of an example here. So recently I had to go to New York, and I had to go to Connecticut. So I was meeting a client at their facility. So I'm driving up the best flight I got was to fly into JFK, and it got in at like 3 o'clock in the afternoon. And of course, just about any big city anymore, 3 o'clock is about midway through rush hour. And so this is New York driver's rush hour. So I'm like, I get into the rental car. Fortunately, I got a small car, and you know, you get into traffic, and oh man, is that a different way of driving than we're used to out here. So in New York, I'll just give you a hint. In New York, if you're that kind natured person who says, no, I'll wait for that opening to open up before I change lanes, you will never change lanes. It's not going to happen. If you, like everyone around you does, stick your nose in between two cars, they'll let you in and you won't get any horns or honking. But if you're that guy waiting, everyone around you is horning and honking and going around you. You're the problem. That's what they're telling you. You're the problem, not us. So when in Rome, do as the Romans. Now, if you want to drive like a New Yorker does in the Midwest, you're going to find out that you're not allowed to drive like New Yorkers do in the Midwest. It's the exact opposite deal. All right. Are you easily provoked, though? Because how many of us have said, I'm not going to ask for a raising of hands here. That would be unfair. Have you ever been frustrated in traffic? I hope to shout. I thought I had a definition here. Let me look back here and see if I actually have a definition. Yeah, provoked means to be stimulated to exasperation or anger. Well, what's exasperation? I had to look that one up because I thought I knew. It means intensely irritated or frustrated. Does that describe an incident you've ever felt that way in traffic? I would say yes. I mean, I'm willing to gamble 100% here. 100% of us have felt that way in traffic before. Okay. The point is we're not ever provoked. The point is, how long is your fuse? I learned when I was in New York to forget all this rude driving behavior and drive like they're telling you have to drive. My wife would have been in a dead panic the whole time. She hates it when I drive that way, and I sometimes drive that way here. I know I do. I get that from my mother, though. I'm just going to be honest about that. She's sitting back there, and I just wanted to acknowledge it's an honest family thing. Okay, now you understand what I'm talking about. It's how long is your fuse? That's agape has a very long fuse. The longest fuse possible. All right. Number 8, agape thinks no evil. This has a twofold meaning. I'll give you both of these meanings. Again, somewhat... They're not like two sides of a coin. They're just a shared meaning of what this is talking about. A, agape does not impute evil motives. This is how we think. Much of what agape is about our motives, what we think about. This is how we think of the other person. When you think the other person positively about, or in other words, impute positive motives to the other person, you are likely to see positive and hear positive from them. You're assigning positive to them, you're likely to get that back. That's what you should expect. Likewise, if you impute negative motives, what are you likely to see in them? Negative. Why? It's called confirmation bias. I tend to believe what I see validates what I want to believe. If I believe you're a negative person and you're going to treat me rudely, the first thing you do that confirms that, I believe it. I want to believe it. It's called confirmation bias. So we have to change how we see people. I can't be imputing negative on everyone around me. You need to start imputing positive motives on them. So when they do something, you don't assume it was done for some wrong motive. You assume they did it out of a right motive. That's how we love them where they are. Impute positive motives to them. And you'll see positive. You'll hear positive back. That's what it's talking about. The second aspect is that agape does not keep track of wrongs up here. There's no list that we're keeping in our heads of how we've been mistreated. That's not what agape does. What does that lead to? Well, I'm remembering a family in Kentucky and in the Kentucky area that feuded for over 20 years over wrongs done one to another, over and over. The families of Hatfield and McCoys. That's just one example of where does this list keeping of wrongs being done to me, where does that lead to? It can only lead to division. It can only lead to hurtful feelings. It can only lead to bitterness, anger and resentment. We don't want to be keeping lists of the wrongs people have done to us. We want to forgive and forget. As much as we can be like God in that respect, we want to forgive and we want to forget. Agape lets go. And agape controls what we think about other people. That's what agape is. We've only covered half of the attributes of agape. And I only touched on them briefly because that's all we have time for. Each one of these attributes is worthy of a sermon. I'm not going to give you 17 sermons here. Some have tried. That'd wear you out. So that means we have some personal Bible study to do on these. That's why I gave you Romans chapter 12 as a hint and a push and a help. Go there, read that. You'll find so much more on this same exact subject, on these same attributes. You'll find them there. I intend to finish this series with the next sermon on why love is the greatest of the three great virtues.